In the studio this morning, I have Dr. Dennis Trussell, who has been with Friends of the Earth New Zealand since its inception, along with Lindsay Jeffs and Philip Alpers back in 1975. So, good morning, Dennis.
Good morning.
Dennis, thank you for coming in. Being involved with Friends of the Earth for so many years, of course, you've seen a lot happen. And, of course, Friends of the Earth have their head office in the UK and have many offices around the globe as well. And as an NGO, they are dedicated to the global environment, here to educate and encourage the general public into ecological solutions and actions. So, Dennis, you also have not only a close affinity to the natural world, you're also a classical pianist, and you teach the piano, and of course, you are a poet as well. So this reminds us very much of the romantic area of Goethe and William Blake. And so you're going to set the stage for us this morning with a poem.
Yes, yes. First of all, I am an unabashed romantic, and I think quite a lot of the clues of philosophy that we can use to build up green ideas lie right back there in the Romantic movement. And yes, I am a poet, and I will read you some segments from a long poem that I wrote. This poem arose from a walk that I made with my wife along the coast of Northland, and we saw two things in the 8 days that this journey took. We saw, of course, a lot of the natural world, but we also saw a lot of the destructive effect of human economic activity. And so I will read first about the negative and secondly about the positive. The poem is called Walking into the Millennium, and these are some short segments from it. Far out against the radar sky, the grey blips of trawlers crawl intricately along the horizon. Diesel fishermen. The ships are eating the names. Hokie, Shark, Orange Ruffy, Tariki, Squid. Eating the kawai in its ballet of lightning. Marine pistons, gyro compasses, such instruments, the precision of sat-nav, feeding coordinates onto maps that are travelled by fishermen. By this lawful hunger is flesh stripped to the void, the swell pregnant with smelt and plankton, the organismic drift stripped by the reasoning of engines and sonar, by the planning of feedlot and quota. You walk through dry bladder rack, heaped, brittle, a chaotic weft of sea plants, threaded with the blue nylon warp of packing straps and dead rope. An imperishable jetsam, sections of net broken from nylon fishermen lie in stiff translucent webs, dry on sandstone shelves. You pick your way past boulder mouths of creeks where, as broken and cracked vessels of plastic, the future is scattered. White signs, they are to be read instantly, among the coast colours of water, rock, sand. It is late to walk the millennium, a stretching frame of time, and in all waters the motors of Homo sapiens are firing, along all horizons, in all zones of ground and sky. The earth is spinning in an atmosphere of engines. Will the engine sea shatter the lava hulk of Maunganui? Will the engine speaking strip the names from the trees of Hauturu and Tutumoi? Will the engine blades split the red earth of Weka Weka and cut the creeks that spill wet light over the sands of Waimamaku? On that question, I'll leave the darker side of the argument, and I'll just read you three stanzas about the natural world of that coastline. Of human birth, you have seen the mass of sun's attraction, build the tidal neap, have seen the invisible pull of moons and water running at the sea mouths, have known the ocean spawn of light, the living deluge and foams, abandoned scuds, torn by wind, drifting ragged over sand plains. Have seen danger as the white of water, its liquid terraces ranked, moving forever inshore, forever sucking back to a chaos that unweaves identity. Death is here the healer for the drowned, the shattered, those spent on a moon curvature of sand, where are thrown bivalve shards, tuatua, mussel, pipi and cockle, all the rack of plants, the fine light bones of birds, and numberless exoskeletons of arthropods. The prodigal release of roe, voluptuous twistings of kelp, and the rich plankton slicks, darkening foam, eros, flooding the shores with desire, the emergent billions, and you among the born gathered into this immeasurable birth, walking across the dark green wash of diatoms, tiny crustacea, the tides of spat and phosphorus, in plants whose cold luminescence is flung at night up the dark flashing slopes of the beach.
Yes, Dennis, some startling imagery you evoke there. Yes, I've walked along some of the beaches up north too, particularly the west coast, and seen the debris from fishing boats along the high water mark. And we have got, of course, a lot of challenges as an island nation. So how did you get involved with Friends of the Earth first?
I was one of a group of friends who started a society called the Beach Forest Action Committee in Auckland in 1973. Our intention was to stop the massive project of the government at the time to log about 900,000 acres or 400,000 hectares of beech forest in the montane country of the South Island. We ran Beech Forest Action Committee for about a year, and then we sort of transmuted ourselves into Friends of the Earth, partly under the influence of the English ecologist Graham Sell, who came out to look at the beech forest milling project. And Graham Sell had started Friends of the Earth in England, and he encouraged us to set up a branch in New Zealand. So we did. Philip Alpers, who became the broadcaster, myself, Lindsay Jeffs, who now works for a small business society in Christchurch, Keith Johnson, who worked for DOC, and Diana Alpers, I think, now Diana Vickhill, was another one of the founding directors. We set it up in 1975, our first brief was to continue our work to try and stop that logging project. Now, with varying degrees of intensity, we've been involved in that until the final victory, nearly 30 years later, when this Labor government decided they were not going to continue with even the remnants of that project. It took 30 years. We were one of the groups who campaigned on it. There were many others also. It was a huge effort to stop that project. So that's really how Friends of the Earth began. And it's still running now, based out of Auckland. It's running to this day.
Because there are lots of eco groups in New Zealand. There's heaps of them, all little regional ones in many cases too, and you've all sort of come under an umbrella of eco. You work together for this change that we need, and I think the big problem is how do we encourage, how do we educate people to be involved with this, or to first acknowledge that there are problems and then get them to action?
Well, Friends of the Earth hasn't been all that active in, I suppose, educating the public. It's been so busy just campaigning that has tended to take up all our energy and resources. But we have tried to, make the obvious points through the media. As with many environmental organisations, our resources are limited. We hope that our campaigns help educate the public. Right now, our most active campaigner is Bob Tate, who's based in Auckland, and he gets quite a lot of media coverage for what he does, and he has a fair degree of success in the campaigns. But if you're talking about a large-scale changing of human consciousness about the environmental problems, I would say at this point we barely scratched the surface. There is a change happening. I think what brought it about was, for the first time, an environmental issue, namely climate change, has become very widely appreciated. Dubious characters like Tony Blair, British Prime Minister, acknowledge that global warming and climate change are happening. So that has caused a big increase, I think, of environmental awareness. The groups like ours, who've been campaigning for 30, 40 years, some of them, and some in New Zealand, of course, for much longer, groups like Forest and Bird go back 60, 70 years. These kind of groups, I think, have prepared the ground for that change. But it's beyond their resources to bring that change about single-handedly. Like Friends of the Earth, most of them are just involved in fighting the campaigns they're involved in, and that takes all their time and energy.
Yes. So what are the main campaigns you're in now here in New Zealand?
Well, I'm not particularly activist myself because I have to now make my living as a musician. But what little time I have, I try and keep a watching brief on transport and energy issues. Bob Tate is involved a lot in issues like water quality issues, the availability of water in New Zealand. Most recently, as you probably know, the Labor government have discussed the possibility of tradable water rights, and Friends of the Earth are strongly against that, and Bob Tate is doing the research and publicising on that issue.
Could you tell us a little bit what a tradable water right?
A tradable water right is it's a kind of privatisation of water. So let's take the Waikato River, because this was particularly a river that was that might become subject to tradable water rights. A big farmer may be able to gain a right to extract a certain amount of water from that river, and they may not need all that water. So then they have the right to pass that allocation on to somebody else, and it becomes a kind of property. Now, we see that as the beginning of the privatisation of water. And we think, you know, if somebody gets a water allocation and they don't use it all, then they simply shouldn't use it, and it should stay in the river and be still part of the common good. Now, in the Waikato River, this has become a very critical issue already, because so many people are using that water. And recently a consortium of businessmen applied for an enormous water right or extraction right to do a big dairy conversion in the Waikato catchment. And they asked for a very large allocation of water, and we wondered if they weren't asking for more than they could possibly need, and that they might actually try and sell off that water and turn it into a profitable good, rather than having it there as a common good. So that's tradable water rights. Now, the Labor government are discussing bringing that in throughout the country. We're against that. We think that obviously people have to have water, and they have to have it allocated equitably, but it should never become a property, a tradable property.
Yes. Ooh. And what are the other ones that you're involved with?
Right now Bob Tate's also involved in a lot of coastal and pollution issues in the Auckland and Northland region. For instance, he keeps a constant eye on the use of 1080. That's been one of our consistent campaigns.
That's a possum colour, is it?
Yeah, it's being used for pest control. And there's a big debate about 1080, as you know, whether once it's been dropped from the air, it's not passed on to other species who eat the bodies of the target species. The usual target species is the possum. And, of course, eliminating the possum is a huge problem. Now, I'm not a specialist in this area at all, but what, as I understand it, Friends of the Earth is arguing for is that if we're going to poison pest species like possums, we should be doing it with poisons that are species-specific, that will only harm that species, that will not go on through the food chain and kill other species. And I think that's our basic position on that. We're not against using a poison on a species as persistent and as difficult to deal with as the possum. It is a very serious problem. But we think the poison should be specific only to the possum. And so that if some kind of ground-feeding bird comes along, pokes its beak into the corpse of a possum that's full of 1080, that bird doesn't also die of 1080. There's lots of arguments about the biodegradability of 1080 and how fast it decays, etc., etc. It is a danger when it's lying around on the ground. Mm. Another issue that we've been pretty active in is genetic engineering. I was the person who fielded that campaign. We gave submissions at the Royal Commission. and spend a great deal of time and effort trying to convince the government not to allow the release of genetically engineered organisms into the open environment in New Zealand. This is ongoing. I've just made a submission, for instance, on the possible release into the open environment of a genetically engineered corn, which will be used for animal feed. This corn is being promoted by the American agribusiness company, Monsanto. The outcome of that, we don't know at the moment. It's still being discussed. It certainly should not be released into the physical environment. So we cover a wide spectrum of issues. We have far too few people to help us, and we're always desperately overworked, basically.
And, of course, funds are also helpful.
Yes, it's the usual problem.
Yes.
Not enough money, not enough workers, not enough time.
And too many issues.
Too many issues, and the competition is always very wealthy and very powerful.
Yes.
You know, they have millions to throw at their propaganda machinery. We have to do it all on the smell of an oily rag.
Yes, I understand that. Now the transport one.
Well, as you probably know, New Zealand is a perfect example of what a country should not do with its transport system. We once had a railway system. That system has been decimated by government indifference, by corporate asset stripping, and by incompetence, and by market-driven ideology. So now we have only the ghost of a rail system. Our basic stand in the matter of transport is that land-based transport must be centred on rail, and that we need to rebuild our rail system, and that it needs to be publicly controlled and publicly owned, or at the very least, any company that operates it is highly accountable to the government. Now, that's our basic position, and I'm not talking here just about commuter trains in Auckland and Wellington, but long-distance passenger transport, long-distance freight. Now, of course, as you know, we're doing the opposite of all these things. We're progressively running down our rail system. In fact, I think it was only late last year that the government finally bought back the tracks, because the tracks had become dangerous. They were so under-maintained by companies that were just asset stripping. So there's been a tiny step in the right direction by the government buying back the tracks. But the government are very reluctant to intervene in redeveloping rail. Now, as you know, the price of oil is steadily climbing, and at this time in history, we need rail more than we ever have needed it before. Instead, as a country, we operate in private cars. We think nothing about jumping in a car and driving 500 miles to Wellington, instead of getting on a train to go to Wellington. We think nothing about jumping into a plane to go to Wellington. Planes, I think the statistic is correct, planes do 20 times more damage to the Earth's atmosphere than the next most damaging form of transport.
Which is the car.
Which is the car. So planes are really a no-no, actually. Although, of course, now we're completely entranced by them, and we would think that we wouldn't be able to live without them. But, of course, we can live without them. I've lived all my life without them, and I've been all over the world. I've very seldom used a plane. to this day, I continue to use what's left of the New Zealand Railways. This, of course, is not very much. I can get from Auckland to Wellington. I can get from Picton to Christchurch, and I can get from Christchurch to Greymouth. I can't get anywhere else, and this is a disgraceful situation. Our forebears laid down the basis of a good rail system, and successive governments and corporations have destroyed it, and it is a public disgrace. Well, Friends of the Earth's position is that that must be rebuilt and extended, and probably also electrified so that it's not dependent solely on fossil fuels. And also that a good coastal shipping system is put in place so you can get more trucks off the road, and that coastal shipping is under, to some degree, at least accountable to public controllers in the form of government, and that we should stop building these lunatic roading systems. So that's our basic stand on transport at the moment. You know, you can I correspond with people like Michael Cullen who are financing these roading projects, and he's very reluctant to change his financing priorities right now. He thinks he's got the right mix. We don't.
Of course, he's also mixing with business people most of the time, and of course, he's only going to get their viewpoint. We've got to have these trucks in now because we can get our exports out, and we can have the next quarter, we can have profit, blah, blah, blah.
Well, the business community probably like the flexibility that roading gives them. But of course, the external costs of that flexibility are very high, and they don't bear those costs. The taxpayer bears them.
And the payment of roads that need to be repaired.
And yes, we bear them in terms of tax, but more seriously, we bear them in terms of the environmental damage that this does. We also pay all the health bills of patching up all the people who are damaged on roads. This is an extremely dangerous way of moving around. So all this is paid for by the commons, the public purse, and the business community get what they perceive to be a benefit. Well, I don't think this can go on. It won't go on because the price of oil is going to rise so significantly that even the business community will start to see the diseconomies of operating like this. But we don't want to have to wait until, you know, oil is $100, $200 a barrel. We need We need to do something about it now, so that when we need to reconstruct the rail system, we can afford to reconstruct it. I wouldn't like to have to reconstruct the rail system when oil was running at $200 a barrel. It would be a very expensive job. We should be reconstructing it now while we still have the resources to do it. Likewise, you know, we should be setting up proper public transport systems in cities like Auckland, where, you know, we have maybe a combination of bus, rail and ferry that is workable while we still have, while we can still afford to do it, because this is the end of the oil era, and so we'd better use whatever we've got left wisely to establish that infrastructure. This is my argument with Cullen, that now is the time that this infrastructure should be being established before the price of oil goes right out of control.
Just to carry this forward a wee bit, there are railway tracks between Auckland and Whangarei, and I think from Wellington, Napier, up to Gisborne. Are these tracks just sitting basically idle?
they carry some freight, and they're not in very good condition. They're under-maintained, and it was only when one of the actual bridges fell over on the rail between, I think, Gisborne and Wellington, what was it? Was it late last year that happened? It was so embarrassing at that point that I think the government decided they'd keep a closer watching brief on the situation. But this is just a nominal gesture, really. I mean, really, the whole thing should be taken back over by the government and reconstructed and enlarged. So, yes, those lines are used for freight, but they are, as I say, they're under-maintained, and they, if they're to carry more freight and get the trucks off the road, then they have to be, in some cases, probably double-tracked, and they certainly have to be better looked after. And it would be a good idea to electrify them too, so that they can be run off the electricity in the grid rather than run directly off imported diesel.
Yes, double tracks are imperative, aren't they, really? So, Friends of the Earth, they're busy here. Can you give us a quick picture of Friends of the Earth in the global picture? Because climate change, again, is a key thing. And I know that Lloyd's London have just put out some statement that they're very concerned about the hurricane season coming into America at the moment. And Munich Re and Swiss Re, the two great other reinsurers, are suffering losses. How can, you know, Friends of the Earth get finance from them to help them, to support, to educate the people?
Well, the I'm not well informed about what Friends of the Earth does in other countries, although we keep a kind of constant contact with Friends of the Earth International, which is their central office, and we are fairly well informed about what Friends of the Earth in England is doing. But Friends of the Earth is in, I think, about 70 countries now. And some of those countries are third world countries that have a different spectrum of problems to developed countries. I'm not one of the people who goes to the conferences where all the people meet up, all the Friends of the Earth people meet up and discuss the whole range of issues, because basically I'm stuck in Auckland as a musician trying to earn my bread and butter. So I can't give you a detailed answer about Friends of the Earth internationally. Tony Juniper, who runs Friends of the Earth in Britain, or is their spokesman on energy, has come out very strongly recently about nuclear power, and I suppose I should mention here that we are thoroughly in agreement with the UK Friends of the Earth about nuclear power. We believe it to be possibly the most dangerous technology that the human race has ever devised, along with perhaps some forms of genetic engineering. And as you would know, in Britain now, Blair has reopened the push to expand the use of nuclear power. Now, I suppose we also are going to be affected by that, although at the moment New Zealand is a non-nuclear country. The Howard government has opened this commission of inquiry into nuclear power. If Australia goes nuclear, and we have to pray that it won't, then I think New Zealand will be under more pressure than ever to abandon its nuclear-free stance. We're already pretty isolated with that, and it's a big worry. I mean, we had hoped that by going nuclear-free, a lot of other non-aligned countries would follow our example. They haven't, and we are very isolated. But I think it's most important that we stay with that.
And what alternatives? Of course, wind power's coming on in New Zealand, and we have got evidently some very good mechanisms to actually drive it from a standpoint of how the technology works. Is there a solar lobby, solar hot water systems on every roof like they have, of course, now in China? China's full steam into solar hot water, and of course Israel's had solar hot water for the last close on 30 years, every building. Admittedly, they are in a sunny place, but I hear that Germany has got a lot of solar hot water as well, and they're closer to the pole than we are, so we should be able to run with that.
Well, my understanding is that it doesn't matter whether the place is sunny or not, because the active part of the sun's energy that works solar heaters can come through even on a grey day. Yes, of course, those renewables, solar and wind, are important and should be developed. It is very strange that in a country like ours, where our population largely live in standalone houses that all have extensive roof space, that the government have not said, well, this is a way we can save an enormous part of our energy bill by putting a solar water heating on the roof of every house. Even if the government subsidised that, it would save them enormous amount of money in the long run. Because as you know, I think water heating in the normal domestic situation eats up, is it? Again, my knowledge of the statistic might be out of date, I'm not sure, but is it 25 or even 50% of the power bill is water heating?
It all depends on how long the teenagers stay in the shower.
But it's very big. It's very significant.
Yeah. 35% possibly, yes.
Yeah, it's very significant. And we would dramatically lower our need for energy just by putting solar heaters on the roof of every house. Recently, I was told by a friend who lives in a rural environment and is reasonably well informed about this kind of thing, that good solar water heaters have been available in New Zealand, not just in the last, 10 or 20 years, but a good model of solar water heater has been available in New Zealand since the Second World War. But we've hardly heard of it. It's had no profile. It's never been promoted. So the technology has been there for a very long time. And with wind power, again, we can use it. My only fear about wind power is that we might go overboard. We've got so much wind that we might go crazy and build far more wind farms than we really need. And we have to look carefully at issues of siting them and at how much power we really need. For instance, a very big wind farm was approved only this week, and it's between Taupo and Napier, and I think it develops 70 megawatts and can provide power to over 50,000 houses. Now, all this is very spectacular. Do we need that wind farm at this point in time? Are we not better, before we build wind farms indiscriminately, to go as far as we can along the energy conservation pathway? Now, I know that energy conservation is just not sexy with the government, and it's certainly not sexy with the corporates. They want more and more plant. I think we should be minimising plant, whatever kind of plant. Even if it's renewables, I don't think we should build unnecessary generating capacity. Obviously, it's far better to build a wind farm than a nuclear reactor. And, if I'm going to opt for one or the other, I would come down very firmly on the side of the wind farm.
I know that in Sweden they have treble glazed, even quadruple glazing in their windows to make sure that they keep the cold out. Now, in New Zealand, double glazing, of course, in the South Island, I think with a recent freeze and the cold snap in the South Island, double, treble glazing would have been really good. Insulation, pink bats everywhere. I mean, when Amy Lovins came to New Zealand many years ago, I think it was back about
1976.
That's when it 76, that's right. Well, I went to his talk, and he came down again. Well, he's been down three times, and I think he's coming down very shortly again. He said that New Zealand could save heaps by just spending all their time on insulation for all buildings and housing. We could cut a lot of electricity wastage.
Yes, well, for some time I helped edit the newsletter of the Government Energy Efficiency Committee. Its job was to promote energy efficient architecture. I wasn't doing this in the name of Friends of the Earth. I was actually doing it for a friend who was an architect, and that newsletter was full of good ideas about how you could save energy. Tons and tons of them. They just don't catch on. That is the problem. These ideas don't, in general, catch on, even though the technologies are already there to carry them out. And I don't know what the magic is to make them catch on.
Rebates, government rebates, tax rebates.
Possibly, and forms of subsidy. As you know, though, we live in a time of almost superstitious belief in the market, and subsidies are viewed very unfavourably. But it makes good business sense. Indeed, it would make very good sense for a lot of big corporate buildings to chuck out all their air conditioning and all their artificial lighting and open up their buildings to natural lighting and natural forms of air conditioning. It would save them a great deal of money, and put solar systems on the roofs of their towers. Why they don't do this, I think, is just an inherent conservatism and a habit of thinking in a certain way. 70 or 80 years ago, one of the architects who was the founder of modernist architecture, Le Corbusier, advocated the building of these huge tower blocks, as you know. Le Corbusier was famous for his advocacy of, you know, highly geometrized, large-scale buildings. But one thing he had very well sorted out, he said these buildings must have natural lighting and natural ventilation. He would be appalled to see how his ideas have been misused in contemporary New Zealand architecture and the architecture of a lot of other countries as well. We now sit in enormous buildings that are closed systems, and they're all dependent on electricity. And there was no need for this. There's absolutely no need for that.
Well, we've got to become more innovative, Dennis.
It is.
And so what other things can we do to enthuse the listeners to get involved? I mean, can you give the box number of Friends of the Earth? Someone
yes.
Wants to donate.
Well, we always welcome financial help. People, we're a limited liability company, a non-profit company, and we depend on subscribers. That's how we survive. People subscribe to the company, and yes, if people want to send in a subscription or a donation, we would be very grateful. Our box number is Post Office Box 5599 Wellesley Street, Auckland. But that's only the beginning of the problem. If there are people out there who have skills and want to help in campaigns, were always able to use their skills, in a wider context, what can one do to help? Well, I have one very simple proposal that I would pass on to the whole population, not only of New Zealand, but of the world. Walk. Walk. If people walked more, quite a lot of the environmentally disastrous events that are unfolding before us and that are dependent on the technologies that we use to avoid walking, quite a lot of that would simply dissolve away. We have lost the habit of walking.
I used to walk 5 kilometres a day in the last few years. I used to walk to work in the city here. 2.5 kilometres in the morning, 2.5, and boy, did I get fit.
Yes, not only is it good for you, but it's good for the environment. It would be just by that simple, re-establishing that simple habit of walking or riding on a push bike, a habit that we had until probably only 30 years ago. I mean, it's not as if this is something that we haven't done since the medieval period. We were reasonably active as a population until the last, 20, 30 years. And suddenly we appear to have forgotten.
Yes, since a lot of the imports of cheap cars come into the country and cheap fuel.
Cheap fuel and cheap cars.
Yes.
And we've lost the habit of being mobile creatures on our own account, of mobilising ourselves.